Now, Jesus must have felt between the frying pan and the fire. In Galilee, the Pharisees informed him that King Herod wanted to kill him. This was the same Herod Antipas that had already beheaded John the Baptist, his cousin. So the rabbi from Nazareth found himself a wanted man in the frying pan of Galilee. But then Jesus looked forward to what awaited him in Jerusalem, the prophet's fate at the hands of evil forces. There before him, the fire that would consume him. So between the frying pan and the fire, Jesus faced deadly opposition wherever he turned. There was no city of refuge for Jesus. Indeed, he had come into his own, and his own received him not. He had no place to hide. Now, the leaders who put the squeeze on Jesus were really a sorry lot indeed. And like so many in authority, they abused their power and harmed anyone who stood in their way. Now, Herod Antipas, Joseph Caiaphas the high priest, and Pontius Pilate the governor all conspired in Jerusalem to do away with Jesus. But their privileged position was not to last long. Check it out in history. Within a decade of Jesus' execution, all three leaders would be run out of office. In 36, Caiaphas and Pontius were relieved of their duties. And 3 years later, in 39, Herod Antipas was removed and banished to what we call France. They did indeed strut and fret their hour upon the stage, only to exit into obscurity. So Jesus considered his tenuous position in his home district of Galilee, and he calls out Herod, "Go and tell that fox," by the way, that is not a compliment, "that I will work my miracles until I am finished proclaiming good news and healing those who are in need." He would leave the frying pan of Galilee when the seed had been planted and not before. And then Jesus turns his face toward Jerusalem and lamented the opposition he would face in the city of David. He saw the fire ahead, the suffering and rejection in the city that stones the prophets. He uttered these painful words of lamentation. "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I would have desired to gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, but you were not willing." Jesus knows that no prophet is acceptable in his home country, neither in his home district nor in the capital city. And he laments. Now, lamentation is a cry of sorrow over the sins and suffering in the world. We lament those too blind to see and too cold to care. We lament leaders who feel threatened by anyone and everyone and then lash out at them. We lament a town without pity that rejects those who speak the truth. So Jesus is actually heartbroken about this city that he loves with a mother's love. How he would gather this brood together under the wings of God's love. But these frightened children hide themselves from God, just like Adam and Eve in the garden. And worse, they turn upon the very one who loved them the dearest. Greater love has no one than this, that they lay down their lives for those who despise them. What a poignant thought. The biblical scholar Walter Brueggemann has taught the church the great importance of voicing to God our lamentations. Like crying out to God, suffering under the weight of Egyptian bondage, or Jesus' sorrow over the bullies that were determined to end his life. Lamentation gives public voice to our personal pain and unites us in solidarity with all who bear the mark of suffering. It takes us out of our isolation. Today in our country, and indeed throughout the world, many feel squeezed in by the current political currents. Federal workers are losing their jobs, many of them veterans. Our allies are worried about a trade war as well as a real hot wars. People of color are stressing about their standing in our society. And retirees are watching their 401ks shrink. Immigrants facing detention and deportation. Gay, lesbian, and transgendered people feeling threatened. Dissidents in peril for lifting their voices in protest. It is a cause for lamentation, for all this uncertainty, anxiety, and fear. I feel it. Do you? We lament what seems to me to simply be a sophisticated form of bullying. Now, all this reminds me of my adolescence, a time of stress for so many young people. The frying pan in the fire of my middle school was, do you remember these days? Merciless kidding, endless ridicule, and relentless bullying. All pretty much unchecked back then by the school authorities. Now, I had two classmates that were polar opposites. Fred was simply a bully from day one in the first grade forward. And Bobby, on the other hand, was the quintessential nerd, as we would say now. Fred never let up on Bobby. Year after year, making fun of this brilliant but very strange young man. Now, Bobby would get his revenge, of course. He would become our high school valedictorian and later a star in Silicon Valley, as you would expect. But Fred kept goading and humiliating Bobby up until the eighth grade. Now, long ago and far away, in Hogg Junior High School in Tyler, Texas, we had a curious custom. Any two students could ask the coaches to let them duke it out with these oversized boxing gloves, and they were really oversized. The idea, I suppose, was to stop schoolyard fights and bring the conflict under the control of the coaches. So Bobby, a very large but awkward eighth grader, publicly challenged Fred to a boxing match in the gym. Fred, of course, thought it was a joke, but it was no joke. And sure enough, at high noon, virtually the entire school gathered in the school gym for the battle of the bully and the nerd. Fred sneered at his lumbering opponent. But Bobby was determined. This would turn out to be one of the most stunning days of my adolescence. Why? Because Bobby, with those oversized boxing gloves, knocked Fred out before our unbelieving eyes. I'm not making this up. All the years of pent-up rage came out in Bobby's wild swings. And luckily, one of those ungainly punches landed solidly on Fred's exposed jaw, and the bully dropped like a rock to the gym floor. I don't think Fred ever messed with Bobby again. Now, I'm not necessarily advocating this as a means of dealing with bullying and school fights. All I know is that when young hearts are humiliated and bullied, we all suffer. Some who've been bullied return to their schools carrying their weapons, and they carry out their revenge. And then we all weep for the young lives lost and ruined forever. Now, there's a poignant song about bullying entitled, Don't Laugh at Me. I hope you will go home today and look online and see the music video produced by its author, Mark Wills. This is a lamentation for all those who've been bullied, for my classmate Bobby, and all those being bullied even to this day. Here are the lyrics of this haunting lamentation. I'm a little boy with glasses, the one they call the geek, a little girl who never smiles because I've got braces on my teeth, and I know how it feels to cry myself to sleep. I'm that kid on every playground who's always chosen last, a single teenage mother trying to overcome my past. You don't have to be my friend. Is it too much to ask? Don't laugh at me. Don't call me names. Don't get your pleasure from my pain. In God's eyes, we're all the same. Someday, we'll all have perfect wings. Don't laugh at me. I'm the cripple on the corner you pass me on the street. I wouldn't be out here begging if I had enough to eat. And don't think that I don't notice that our eyes never meet. I'm fat. I'm thin. I'm short. I'm tall. I'm deaf and blind. Hey, aren't we all? Don't laugh at me. Don't call me names. Don't get your pleasure from my pain. In God's eyes, we're all the same. Someday, we'll all have perfect wings. Don't laugh at me. Brothers and sisters, the Church of Jesus Christ is where we raise our lamentations for all those who are bullied. And by God's grace, we wrap our arms around them for the sake of Christ our Lord, who faced the frying pan and the fire, the bullies who did him in. Lord, have mercy. Christ, have mercy. Lord, have mercy upon us.